Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And that, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, a Shoot the Wisps subcast.
Heavenly Creatures, directed by Peter Jackson.
That's pretty much all you need to know, right? No?
Right.
Okay, well,
I was just giving the title to start with. I thought we'd introduce ourselves before we actually talk about the plot.
Fair enough, okay.
The good people don't know who's here besides you, Sean, and me, and who else is here?
I'm Stina, I'm here.
I'm David, Hello. And I'm here too.
Awesome. All right, well, we're all introduced then. So obviously, we are watching the New Zealand sort of kind of spec fic film called Heavenly Creatures. That's actually a question I was really curious about when we selected this film as part of the World SF Tour, is whether or not we actually consider this to be genre in the sense of SFF. And I have a kind of it's kind of conflicted, I think, for me, because there are elements of this that are clearly fantastic, but there are also elements that are imaginations on the part of the characters. So I wonder what other people had thought about that. Does anyone have any opinion in that regard?
I do.
Go, Paul.
It definitely felt much more like a drama than a fantasy. I mean, we're really concerned with the inner lives and the interconnection between these two characters. The fantastic elements are counterpoint rather than essential to the plot. Given the plot of the novel of the story and what they do, the fantasy is not integral to it. In other words, they could have had this. I mean, their writings could have been about any sort of place, and they sort of had the same obsessive sort of relationship. The fact that it's a fantasy world is incidental in a way.
Okay. Well, I think. Maybe unless other people have their direct opinion, but maybe sideline exactly what Paul said, because I suspect that's going to be something we're going to want to talk about in more depth.
Okay.
Is that fair? So maybe we should actually describe this movie. So who wants to take a stab at describing what this movie's about? Awkward silence. Awesome.
Okay, I will describe this movie then.
Go for it, Paul.
Okay, this movie follows the melodramatic relationship between Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume, two New Zealand girls in the 1950s. They meet as Juliet's transferred to Pauline's school, and they develop an intense, obsessive relationship, which eventually leads to murder. They're relationship bends and twists the world around them and the characters around them until their relationship leads to tragedy.
Yeah, and the details, of course, they kill Pauline's mother.
Yes. Yeah. I wasn't sure if I wanted to reveal that immediately, but yes, they do kill Pauline's mother. Although we do see in the beginning, we do see them blood covered at the beginning.
And then she screams that their mother's dead. There's been a terrible accident. Her mother's dead. Yes. So I don't think it's a mystery when you start the film. The mother gets killed quite brutally.
Particularly for New Zealand audiences, this is such a famous case that they'd know going in.
Okay, so it would have a certain resonance locally, which we wouldn't have because we're on the outside. That's interesting. So why don't we start with general reactions, and we'll just start from – I'll just go from left to right. We'll start with you, Paul. General reaction?
I'd never actually seen – unlike the three of you, I've never actually seen this movie before. I watched it a few days ago, so I'd known about the movie. I'd heard of the movie. I'd heard of the case. My mother is big into true crime, and so she – I know my mother had mentioned reading a book about this case. She had never seen the movie. My mother's not big movie nut, so I came to it with relatively fresh eyes. I found the opening interesting. That whole weird 1950s sort of film documentary on Christchurch. I found the cinematography very, very interestingly period, especially with the use of color and the saturation of color. I loved how the music counterpointed the action strongly throughout. It seemed like the music was very much geared to what was happening on the screen at the time. And since a lot of that music is opera, the whole movie took on for me a very operatic, melodramatic tone, which is very much in keeping with the facts of the case.
Okay. And what about you, David?
Well, for me, the experience of seeing this film for the first time in 1994 was a revelation. I'd already been a Peter Jackson fan for some time. Was a particularly huge fan of Meet the Feebles and Dead Alive. And so I was very curious to see this because this was a radical change of pace for him. It was his first film where a murder happened that wasn't hilarious. And so it was suddenly seeing him, even though it in some ways it felt like a logical progression from Dead Alive, because that also was set in a period. And some of the same cast from that film is in there, but all of a sudden his focus was on the relationships, on the performances, and though there was still that wild visual imagination, the exuberance behind the camera that was there with the other films, the focus was so different. And that the murder scene, when we get to it, I think is still probably the most chilling moment in his entire filmography. So it was it was an extraordinary experience seeing that for the first time, and I did very much enjoy watching it again.
Excellent. All right. What about you, Stina? General reactions?
Initially, I saw it in the theater. I guess, was that 1994?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
when that was? The first time I saw it, it deeply disturbed me, very deeply disturbed me, for reasons having nothing to do with the film. But then, since then, I have actually gone back and watched it again, actually two more times, which should probably tell you something about the film. Actually, it's a very good film, and I have to say I like it, even though it is extreme. I find it extremely disturbing, for a whole host of reasons. But it was, I love the way it was filmed. I love the way the story is told. It's very, very eloquently done. Eloquently told. I do love this movie. I just do.
All right, fair enough. Okay. I won't have too much to add. I would just say that I saw this not in 1994 because I was not old enough to have seen this by myself. So I will say that I was not in the theater that day because I couldn't see rated R movies for another 7 years. So I did see it much later in my 20s, and now I'm 100. So this is the second time I have seen it. I remember the first time seeing it, I was rather intrigued because of the settings that Paul's already talked about, these sort of fantastic elements that are part of the kind of internal imaginary universe in these characters' minds. I think coming back to it, I still really found it quite fascinating. And I do think it's quite a good film, although I had some issues with some of the performance, but I think that's just because it's a 90s film. And I have no way of backing that up. I'm just making that an assertion that I'm now going to say is true. I just feel like it does have a style to it that feels a little worn now. And that may be just because I would not have been a film buff in the 90s because I was young. I mean, I was like, I want to watch Star Wars. That's basically what I was like in the 90s. So I wanted to see stuff blow up and, you know, car chases and aliens running around and Ninja Turtles. I mean, that's basically what I would have been interested in the 90s. So I feel like that is the perspective that I'm coming from as somebody who is not from that era in which I'd seen the development of film. And so I'm going backwards again and sort of watching stuff that's older and finding it not matching to what I expect films to be in terms of certain aspects. But I see David wants to completely disagree with me and tell me I'm full of crap. So go for it.
Well, you know, I was working on my doctorate when I saw this film, so I really, really hate you right now. But regarding the style of the performances, I don't think that there's been a change in acting styles, particularly. I mean, the 90s are we're not looking back to, say, the 40s or the 50s here. However, the film is set then. And Jackson also, particularly in films like Dead Alive and this one, he's getting a very mannered, very stylized performance out of his cast. Right, they're grotesques. In fact, this is almost of a piece with things like Meet the Feebles and Bad Taste, where all of the performances are pitched extremely broad. You know how easily we slip between especially adults looking like, you know, horrible caricatures, and then they turn into clay puppets, right? So I think the style of the performance that we're seeing, excuse me, is a mixture of the period in which the film is set, but also the kind of surreal or hyperreal aesthetic that Jackson is going for there.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that makes me like it differently. So, no, I mean, that's something to think about too. And there's an aspect, I guess, that what might also be considered is how embedded it is into these two characters' minds. Which could also be coloring the way in which Jackson was trying to present the performances. Although it's just weird to think of it in that way, because usually, like, when you have a literary work, you know, you can literally get into the character's mind, and that's, in terms of film, is almost impossible. Although in this case, we do have some monologue or narration by Pauline. So, yeah, I mean, there's some aspect of that, too. So I see Paul had a hand, so why don't you also tell me why I'm wrong?
I'm not going to tell you why you're wrong. I just wanted to branch off from that a little.
Okay.
And when we have the point of view of either Pauline or Juliet, things do seem hyper-real, hyper-stylized, that operatic melodrama I talked about before. When the point of view switches to one of the other characters, things change and look a little different, skewed. I mean, sometimes it's much more straightforward, and other times, like the scene where Juliet's father's going to be sacked, is, wow, that sounded very British to me. Also seems a little strangely strained. Jackson was definitely experimenting and using stuff from his earlier au revoir here, and I think he uses it to good effect.
Yeah, I think it's important to under... I really like Paul's point about it feeling melodramatic from Pauline's point of view.
Yeah.
Because I think that is an interesting cue to point out that she's not really operating on all four wheels.
It's a mixed metaphor.
Ta-da! Thank you.
Yeah, I mean you're right. I guess like what I would, this is maybe just my criticism in terms of if that is what Jackson intended was to represent the real world through a lens that is distorted by the characters. I guess for me the problem is this film is in many respects about the descent of these two characters into obsession, and so I feel like we need a component of a world that's not that distorted from the start, a world that seems like, because I mean there's a, and maybe this is just because the focus is so much on, I mean, the very first minutes of the movie is when Pauline and Juliet meet. But it does seem like characters will mention, like the mother will say, she used to be such a sweet girl. And it's like, well, we've never seen that. Because the only person we've seen is we see this sort of shy person and then this incredibly mean person at times. And very quickly an obsessive person. And I guess that for me is just a problem of the frame of reference, is I have no reference to know what this character was like prior. So all I have is distortion, which, yeah, but I see David has a hand. Yeah.
Well, I think that is a point that you're right. We don't really see the either of the two girls before any of this happened, so you don't have, you know, what were they like before, or we hear something of their backstory, but you're right, we don't see the, you know, was there a happier person there earlier. But as to the distorted qualities of the world, I think one of the points of the film is that this is a world that distorts, right? That it's the, what happens to these two characters is it's not entirely a product of who they are and the nature of their relationship, but the world that they're in, which is destroying them also. And when we begin with that little propaganda piece of "Welcome to Christchurch," which is so, I mean, it's almost like the opening of Blue Velvet or something like that, right? The exaggeratedly cheerful, it's that awful kind of 50s conformity thing going on again. So that this isn't, and we look at what happens when they go to, when Pauline is taken to see the doctor, right, who can't even pronounce the word homosexual without almost having a stroke. So they are in an environment which is itself wrong and twisted and distorted, and their fantasy world becomes one of the ways of coping with that.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I really hope we were going to talk about was I did like that, you know, obviously I have just issues with some aspects which we're kind of teasing out, but I did really, really like those opening scenes after the like documentary footage part, because I felt like it established the sort of constricting nature of this society so perfectly. I mean, one of the first things they have is they go to mass, right? And they're all supposed to be singing, and there is this, the headmaster, I'm assuming the headmaster woman, whatever her role would be, is like watching these students like a hawk. Yes. Looking for the one who is not doing what she's supposed to do, which of course happens to be in this moment Pauline, who for some reason is sullen and isn't too happy with. Well, I mean, I can understand that sounds really boring, but that moment, even just that little scene, just encapsulates how constricting this society is. And even this moment when Juliet first shows up and she confronts her teacher to correct her on her French. Is this moment at which you very, very clearly get the idea that that authority is not to be questioned here. Even when authority is wrong, it's absolute 100% subservience to this system. And it is a system. It's not just like you're supposed to do things because that's good for everybody. No, everybody has to do these things. That's just the way we do it, period. That's the end of it. There's no discussion over this. You will sing your song in church. That's it. And there are aspects of that that exist outside of the school, but I do see the school as the primary one, where, I mean, even when the very first time when Juliet and Pauline are doing painting, right, they get paired up kind of against Pauline's, you know, will. She doesn't really want to be with anybody. And Julia doesn't paint what she's supposed to paint, and she gets reprimanded for it. Even though what she does paint, the teacher even acknowledges, is good. It's just not what she was supposed to do, so therefore she's being punished. So I think that that tone is set very early on, and I think that that's something that resonates through the later parts, because, of course, Pauline identifies her mother with that same system, which becomes a motivation for why she decides they have to get rid of their mother. And even as David, you were suggesting the doctor as being a part of this too, who, you know, in this grand assertion that somehow we're going to come up with treatments to cure the gay, basically, and actually not listening to anything that Pauline's saying. She's not actually indicating in any way that she is interested in Juliet in a homosexual light, and yet everybody seems to assume that of her, and that must necessarily be deviant. It's very constricting, and I think the film does a great job of presenting that. And Sina, did you have a hand? You have a hand.
Yeah,
go.
I did. There is some question, even on as to whether or not that the homosexual aspects are actually happening. You know, I feel kind of weird about that aspect of it because, I don't know, sometimes I've had friendships with women where it was, we call them girl crushes, you know, you're just very, very attracted to that person and you want to be with them and all this, but it's not a sexual thing. It's just a very close, tight relationship. There's this person that you really, really identify with.
Sure.
And you have a lot in common. And you just hit it off right away and you want to spend like all your time together. I'm not sure if that is something that males go through.
It is. We have that. Yeah.
Okay. So I could never, for me, watching the film, I could never figure out if the problem was, yes, indeed, there is a sexual quality to this, and everybody, oh my gosh, homosexuality, oh my gosh, they're lesbians! Or if it's just them putting that on a relationship that just doesn't fit their idea of what a relationship between two girls should be. For me, there was a lot of confusion on that point. And that was part of the disturbing aspects of it, you know? How attracted can you be to somebody before it becomes this horrible, horrible secret? You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Go for it.
Yeah. And that's actually a really good thing, that to bring up too, is, I feel like this society assumes that they're physical, because there is a certain degree of physical intimacy in the film. I mean, we've seen it, but for anyone who's never seen it, they hang on each other quite a bit. You know, they hug, they essentially kiss each other quite a few times. And there is a moment when they have what appears to be a sexual experience, but they're only using their bodies as a mediator for the fantasy world, in which they are presumably married to the clay creature of some description. And so that's one of the things I think is interesting here, is it is this society wants them, or at least the way Jackson presents society wants to pigeonhole this as a sexual relationship, and therefore it is deviant, rather than looking at the fact that this is only a sexual relationship because they are exhibiting certain aspects of their fantasy world onto the real world, not that they themselves are attracted to one another in that light.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly, yes. Thank you for translating that.
No, yeah, I think it's a great point, and I think it's something that has a real relevancy to the way in which we consider sexual behaviors in general, because we just assume that, like, if two girls kiss, lesbian, that's it. End of discussion. It's like, well, no. You know, you could kiss another girl, and there could be no There could be no real desire there. It could be a certain other kind of intimacy. And I see Paul has a hand, and you haven't talked much, so I'm going to shut up and let you talk.
I've been talking plenty.
That's true.
That the fantasy and sexual relationship that even goes to Pauline's single sexual encounter with the border, where she's clearly using him as a vessel for projecting that the fantasy man from her kingdom onto him. So it's clearly the whole basis of their sexual relationship is the working out of this world that they've built together. I did find it weird that after the border gets kicked out and she gets punished, it never gets mentioned again. It almost seems like a dangling plot line that I was thinking about. Like, it's just really of a piece with the relationship with Juliet and how they're basically using their fantasy world and using sexual contact as a way of reaching that world, for lack of a better way. It's a way of reaching the quote-unquote fourth world, besides going through the clouds, it is.
Hmm. David?
Well, I think perhaps one of the reasons it doesn't come up is how singularly, I guess, irrelevant it ultimately became for Pauline. Because when we see her fantasy in the scene with the border, I would say she's not using him so much as she's using the fantasy to escape from this moment, which is underwhelming, to put it mildly, right? So she escapes into her world, and then she's there with Orson Welles, who later on will kill the clay incarnation of the border. Right, who's irritating beyond words. Whereas when she and Juliet are together and they're getting the projections of Orson Welles and James Mason, and they are they are providing each other with the joy and the experience that Pauline was just not getting in the completely one-sided encounter that she had with the border.
Yeah.
I like that.
I corrected.
I kind of agree with David on that. I do think that moment is her escaping what is clearly not very exciting an experience. Because I think initially she goes to the border as an act of rebellion. And it's something that is indicated later when the mother is like basically saying, I'm ashamed of you. You should be ashamed of yourself, etc. because of what you're doing, and Pauline throws back at her, but you did it. And I mean, that, what a perfect retort, because the mother can't say anything about it. What does the mother say? You know? And I do think that is an act of rebellion, her going over to what used to be the border's house. And then there's this comical aspect that he like follows her around like a lost puppy dog, which I didn't know what to make of that, because I feel like, I don't know. I took the impression that he was an adult man, and that essentially he was committing an act of molestation, possibly a form of rape, because that first experience they have together, which almost becomes sexual, but the father finds out, all of that seemed super creepy to me.
Yep, and I had the same sense of it.
And I thought that was intentional, but yet it becomes very different. It's almost in the second instance, she's the one that seems to almost take some degree of control, and then she discards him, and it's him that becomes latched on, which seems like a reversal of what we'd associate with the victim relationship, which is they become dependent in some cases on the... Well, in this case, we're talking about a teenage girl who's being essentially molested by an older man. And in some of those cases, what ends up happening is that person doesn't perceive what's happening is necessarily wrong. And in this case, I feel like it's clear that it's wrong, although the film may not address it in that light. But at least I'm not the only one that got super creep vibes from the first time he shows up in the room. Just knew exactly what was going on the second he walked into the room. I mean, this... It was
absolutely,
like,
absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree. For me, it just, one of the beauties of this film is that it actually portrays just how messed up, messy, confusing the whole teen girl experience can be. Because there's no, trying to navigate through so much of all of the things that actually happen versus all of the things that are supposed to happen, all of the things that are projected upon you, the things that you have to decide whether or not you're going to accept or reject, all of that stuff is just one giant mess for a very long time. Until it takes a very long time to sort all that stuff out. And depending on how screwed up things can get, and I have to say, speaking, some of my friends had some pretty messed up childhoods. It could take the rest of your life and you may not ever sort it out. But yes, that definitely creeped me out, and I'm completely with you on that, Paige.
I think we were supposed to be creeped out, right? Because the it's set up with that first person camera creeping towards her door, and you know, the hand reaching out in sort of pure stalker mode. So you know, I think we're supposed to be sort of recoiling as the scene begins.
Yeah, I mean, how old are the boarders supposed to be? Like college age? I mean, that was
my impression.
Yeah, I got the impression that they were quite young.
Just past adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that's true, although I know very little about 50s New Zealand, so, yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, you're right, David. Yeah, I forgot about the first-person camera view, and that just makes it worse, creepy that moment is. And I just found it really interesting how the film was trying to approach that, although I didn't feel that the film addressed it, and perhaps that's to do with something you'd said earlier, David, was that this film, in some respects, is not... that it excises what appears to not be of interest to Pauline, who is the primary perspective of the film. And so perhaps because it's a question she never asks herself, the film therefore never asks it either, or at least never addresses it at length on purpose. I wonder if that'd be an interesting way of reading it, that the things it leaves out, the questions that we might ask because we're the audience, are questions that she does not ask because it's not of interest to her for whatever reason. It's just a really interesting way of looking at the whole film. What did you make of that way in which the film dealt with obsession? I mean, just that's kind of a generalized question, but anybody want to kind of address that first?
I'll go.
Go for it,
Paul. Go ahead.
It was a nice descent into the madness of the entire thing. Mm. I mean, there were the reversals when they were split apart, and then there's the shocking. That wonderful, best scene cinematographically for me and musically for me is when they quote unquote reunite for that last 3 weeks, and we see. Juliet as the film star. And the music playing and all about reunion. I thought that's really showing them, okay, now they're getting together and now they're going to whirl down into the ultimate bit of where this obsession is going to take them. So we do see them slide down towards that, with punctuated by when their parents try to break this relationship apart, and then that last bit is just the straight shot down the tube and seeing how far it goes. This is where we get the creepy sexual experience between the two of them. We get we get their bit with Orson Welles. It's not a single smooth journey except for that last bit, which is just the plunge down. And I appreciated the landscape of that as they. We see them write the letters to each other, which is a kind of a different frame of the obsession when Juliet's in recovery, so we get to see all sorts of ways in which they obsess with each other and eventually go to what it leads to and the horrific murder.
Yeah. I also really thought that there was an interesting aspect about you brought up Orson Welles, which I think is a really great example of the way in which their obsession encroaches on reality. Because that whole scene is, they've just left the movie theater having seen an Orson Welles movie. I can't remember what the movie was now.
The Third Man.
Third Man.
Yeah, Third Man, which I'm assuming is a classic Orson Welles.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I haven't seen it, guys. Sorry. Don't bite my head off. That scene, I think, is the moment when the film finally takes the turn over from just people maybe imagining a fantasy world and sometimes falling into it in their minds to this is a fantasy world that is officially gone in and taken over their sense of reality, because they literally imagine him chasing them through town. And then of course this is the moment it leads also to their sort of first sexual experience. And that for me, I think, was the turning point at which I realized there was no turning back, that they were going to go through with that, what they'd already suggested they were going to do, or at least Pauline had suggested, which is that she's going to kill her mother. I mean, in the sense that I knew that their motivations as character, we already knew that she did, they do it, because of the very beginning. But anyway, does anyone else want to make a thought on the obsession? Maybe David.
Well, I think one of the things that it does is it we have obsession and imagination blending together, and perhaps the difficulty as to, you know, when one becomes the other, on the one hand, the nature of their obsession is played out in those elaborate fantasies like you just described, but those same fantasies are the things that give them joy in a world that is distinctly unfriendly to them, and the movie itself is obsessive and deeply imaginative, so that it exalts in the texture of their fantasies that we get to experience in such wonderful, explosive detail. When we move towards that, the horrific murder, we feel every detail, right? We get the texture of the ground as we go from the dirt to the mud and the stones, and, you know, we are and the time drags out so that we are feeling every second, every moment. So the film is making us obsessed just as much as it is. And then in this too is the whole nature of film. Right, that which is a the voyeuristic medium that encourage that one becomes obsessed with is a means of displaying obsession. But this movie is also obsessed with other movies, right? Just as our two girls are constructing their fantasies partly out of their frames of reference from film and expect to go to Hollywood and become famous and so on. And then it's the Orson Welles that we get from The Third Man. We get the opening of the film is straight up the opening of The Prime of Miss Jean Brody and the vision of the school that we get there. We could very easily have Maggie Smith as one of the teachers in there. So we're getting all of our references I think we are invited to become as obsessed as our two main characters.
That's an interesting way of looking at that.
Yeah, I like that.
Also a little creepier. Thank you, David. This film, anytime, you basically just argued is mind screwing us. It's trying to take over. It's colonizing our brains.
Well, the thing for me, I think, is rather interesting and disturbing, is the aspect of the fact that one of the girls actually does end up becoming a professional writer. And speaking, I can identify with having a very rich, and I do mean very rich, imaginary world as a kid. That's basically, I spent a great deal of time playing pretend and building up stories in my head and telling myself stories every night before I went to sleep and all of that stuff. So I definitely, just sitting there, watching this person who eventually becomes a writer, whose obsession with story and imaginary world leads them to kill someone was, I just found that to be very disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, because I think it goes to something that we were talking about off podcast, which is today the conversation about mental illness is shifting. It's shifting from it being the necessary cause to being the thing that we're supposed to be addressing so that we can prevent. And in this case, I don't know the details of the case, but I strongly suspect that I know that that Pauline did try a defense of insanity, which was rejected, and so that it leads me to conclude that in this era it was very uncommon for anyone to even discuss mental illness as a basis for one's actions. Whereas today, that's actually quite the opposite. We talk about that constantly, even when people commit horrifying acts of violence. We're constantly talking about, well, what could we have done as a culture to have prevented this moment? And so this film seems to be, in a respect, working within that system, that older view. I mean, obviously, because it's set there, duh. But it, playing into these ideas of how obsession leads to what appear to be rather horrendous acts, but yet I don't think that when we get to the end, we are supposed to feel sorry for these characters, as opposed to somebody who perhaps does literally, because it seems like they actually relish in what they go through. Although, I don't know. I'm kind of rambling and not really saying anything that makes any sense, and I'm just going to shut up now.
I thought it was very interesting that they had their imaginary idea of how this was going to play out as far as their plot for murder. And then they had the train crash that was the reality. They couldn't really bop her on the head once and then poof, she's magically gone. They had to do so much to kill her, had so much effort. And the horror between the two, and to have them realize when it's too late to turn around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and actually, what little details I know of the case, apparently when they committed this act in the real world, they did mostly what the film shows. They run up screaming, "Oh my god!" And you know, they're screaming about that she's dead and they're covered in blood. But they tried to pass off that the mother had fallen, you know, down an incline or down a hill and had banged her head and had died. But when they found the body, understandably, it looks nothing like what a head would look like if it were to smash into a rock while rolling down a hill. And because apparently, for reasons that I suspect have to do with their individual madness or obsession, they did not hide the nylon stone all that well. It was easily found by authorities, so they knew their whole story was bullshit. And I think in the film that it's trying to get this idea that in their minds, this makes total sense. And everything that they're thinking about in terms of their great plans are going to go to Hollywood and they're going to become actors or actresses and all of this stuff that in their minds, it makes total absolute sense. To anyone on the outside, it's not. It sounds like in some cases pipe dreams, in some cases completely nuts. I mean, to think that they would have gotten away with this, there's a certain degree that they're very much out of touch, even on that basis alone, whether or not that is necessarily that they are mentally ill or something of that nature is a whole other question. It's just certainly not in touch with how the real world works, which I think this film does a good job of making clear that they're not in touch with the real world at all. They seem to reject it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I know, David, you kind of tried to talk earlier, so I'll let you talk.
Oh, sorry. I was wondering if to ask, is this really a film about mental illness? I mean, I don't know that they are. If we're supposed to see them as mentally ill,
I don't think we are.
Yeah,
maybe that's just baggage I'm bringing in. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry, but there is the point where they do decide that they're mad. We see the little banner unfurl in Barovia of mad. We see Dr. Hume dressed up as a mad jester. So they certainly bring up the idea that they're crazy,
but it's their Hollywood version of madness that they're embracing,
right. True. Not real mental illness. Yeah, it's a stylized almost glamorized version of madness that they bring into it. Like, oh yes, we're crazy.
Maybe that's just baggage I bring in. Maybe because it is something that we now discuss in a very different light. That maybe I'm bringing that baggage, and maybe that was not something that Jackson and the was it Philippa Boyens who helped him?
Fran Walsh.
Maybe that was not their intention. This was never going to be a film that was about mental illness in the sort of traditional sense that we understand it, in a psychological sense, but is really about a madness in a very different light. Stina, you were trying to talk and I cut you off, so go ahead.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to say that I think there is an aspect of mental illness to this. I do. I don't think that any therapist would say that those girls were...
Oh, no, I think, yeah, you're right, absolutely. That I think
they
in
might...
our world, they would not diagnose them as normal.
No, I don't think so. I think they'd have probably given them some sort of diagnosis. Now, whether or not it would be, you know, something as extreme as schizophrenia is a whole nother thing. I don't think that is as far as it goes. I think it's more something else altogether, right? But
yeah.
So I don't think you're far off base, but I don't believe that we're supposed to feel sorry for them, because I don't. I feel like the entire thing is just a huge tragedy. I don't feel sorry for them. I don't feel like... I just feel like it's a giant tragedy. It's a mess. It's filled with people making huge, vastly huge wrong decisions one after another.
Yeah.
But I don't think that they... I don't think it's in the sense that gets them off the hook that they're crazy. So David wants to talk.
I need to correct myself. I use the word normal when referring to whether or not some, and I should not have done that. That's incorrect. Because it made it seem like somehow if you're mentally ill, then somehow you're naturally abnormal. And I don't want, that's not the intention. Sorry. So I need to correct myself before I left it. So go ahead, David.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Stina was just saying about whether we feel sorry for them or sympathy. I wonder if maybe the film is seeking to create understanding for them. Because I think, I mean, with all of the characters, I mean, especially with their parents who do have these distinctly caricature-like qualities to them, and yet the film is always careful to give a very strong humanizing moment to each one of those characters. So that, I mean, I found myself feeling really sad for all of them. That this was the world that they lived in, which does this to people. Right. I mean, that scene where Juliet's father is sobbing after he's lost his job, and I mean, even though the murder comes and you desperately don't want it to happen, and it's so awful, and yet I found myself very much, you know, caring very deeply for Pauline and Juliet, and wishing it could turn out otherwise.
Yeah, and this actually was a question I was really curious about, because it seemed to me that that even though this is a film that's obviously about Pauline and Juliet, it also seems to me that it's a film that, as David, you were suggesting, that the ways in which all of these people are trapped in this system, because even the mother, Pauline's mother, I felt particularly, there were some moments when I was like, all right, like, but, you know, ignoring that I know how this movie ends, there were moments in which I was like, okay, the mother's being, you know, ridiculous, you know, when they're getting on her case about the creepy guy in the bed, like, my thought was, why did they never ask her what she says, like, because the moment at which that happens, right, she actually says to him, what are you doing, right, because there's almost this innocence in that moment where she doesn't really understand what he wants, although we all do. And so that there's that moment when it seems like she's really mean, but then the further you get in, the more you realize, like, this poor mother is trying desperately to save her daughter from what she sees as a downward slope to bad places. And she may be going about it the wrong way, and it's the fact that she is at times almost crippled and unable to actually help her daughter because of the system she lives in, because she doesn't have the tools. The system provides her no tools. I mean, literally the only tool they have is the Humes come and say, why don't you take her to this one physician guy I got who isn't actually a psychologist or psychiatrist, but sometimes he dabbles in this, so he might be able to help you. And, you know, what they end up getting is they get confirmation of their fears, but they don't get any – I mean, literally, they get nothing from this doctor. This doctor basically says it could be a phase, but if it's not, maybe medicine will have an answer for you. And it's like, but that literally provides them nothing. All that does is it provides a name for the fear. It provides no means by which he can help them with their daughter, like no way for them to reconnect, because that's the moment at which – literally, Pauline hates her mother. She despises her mother. And that's got to be excruciating for a mother to have, any kid hate you. So I feel like that there are a number of characters we come to, I think, feel sorry for. Except I don't feel sorry for Juliet's mother because I think she's a mean person.
For me, that was the thing that was so disturbing to me about this film. Sure. Is that being able to identify with individual characters in the film and yet knowing that they're making these just horrific decisions and doing these awful, awful things to one another. And for me, that was just the root of it. I really could identify with and understand. And I don't know. I think that's part of the film's beauty, frankly.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're running... at this point, probably getting close to probably wanting to stop. So, any last things that anybody really wanted to bring up?
I was curious whether I was supposed to read any sort of class difference between Pauline and Juliet in this film. I mean, Juliet's clearly of a higher class. I mean, they're from England. Her father is in a position of authority and respect, well, for most of the movie, and... I mean, and when they're considering going to America, it's Juliet's house they're going to raid for stuff to sell, not Pauline's. I didn't really see that, but I was just wondering, maybe I was just seeing something that wasn't there, and just incidental that Juliet was more aristocratic, for lack of a better word, than Pauline.
Oh, yeah, I think so, Paul. I really, really do. I agree with you. I totally got that sense, and I also felt like that was... an aspect of why the parents thought the relationship was unsuitable.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Like, well, she's from the wrong side of the track, sort of
thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. Though Juliet's mother is very accepting of her for the first while. Right. And in fact, refers to her as her foster daughter. But I do think, I agree that the class stuff is definitely part of it. And in there too. Yeah.
Although
like moment. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm sorry. I totally
agree. Well, that moment when Pauline's mother meets Juliet for the first time and is clearly like, it's like the mother is shy, right? And doesn't know how to, when Juliet comes out and offers her hand to shake, and there's this sense of how do I, it's like she's entertaining royalty or something like that and doesn't quite know what to do.
Oh, good. I wasn't misreading that then. Excellent.
Yeah. Although I would argue, if I were to do an analytical reading, I don't think that the Juliet's mother's taking on a Pauline as a foster sibling is... I think that's actually more of an indication of her seeming belief in her superiority in that moment as a class issue. Because I see it as... I mean, because why would you want her to be your foster kid, your stepdaughter or whatever, in a moment when unless otherwise you feel some she put a Frenchy word in there and I can't pronounce that, so thank you for making me look really dumb on the podcast, guys, appreciate it. I mean, there is, I feel like that moment is one of those where she's taken her on because it's as if Pauline is missing something from her actual family life. And this family can offer it, and I think that has a lot to do with their wealth and their positions of authority and status. But, I mean, obviously we could tease that out in a lot more depth, but so I think you're right, Paul. I think there is an aspect that's very true here, and I think it's very significant that Pauline focuses her attention on Juliet in her home environment as opposed to the other way. She spends most of her time over there as opposed to the opposite direction.
Right. The scenes where Juliet's there are much more awkward and much more at odds than when Pauline gets to go visit the royalty, so to speak, the noblesse oblige that they show to Pauline, as Stina pointed in the comments. Yes.
Well, the last thing I just want to say is, am I the only one that really loved Pauline's father?
Oh, yeah. The bit with the fish I thought was classic.
He's so cute.
He's very salt of the earth, yes.
Yeah, and even that moment when Juliet comes over and he's showing this profound interest in their writing, and like Pauline is just like, she hates her father at this moment, and like Juliet is just divulging all this information, and he's so excited, and he's like, I can't wait to read it. Maybe you'll read one of mine. Maybe one of the local papers will publish it. You know, and like he's just so like supportive and into this moment. I love him.
Yeah.
I also feel sorry for him because even though he's not the one that gets killed, he clearly is having to deal with the aftermath.
Absolutely.
I feel bad for him. Yeah. I want one. All right, guys. All right. Well, actually, I like the way this discussion went. I like it because it's more organic and it was a little bit deeper than just kind of going into things we enjoyed and didn't enjoy. I mean, I don't know if you guys felt that way, but I did.
Yeah,
I think it was a good discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. So why don't we grade the film? Because I'm going to keep that part. So we'll start with you, Paul. What would you grade it on an A to F scale?
I'll go ahead and give it an A. I mean, some of the special effects, especially with Barovia, look a little dated when we see that. On the other hand, I can see why they would have thought Peter Jackson doing a fantasy film in New Zealand, he could do that after seeing those few shots we see of Barovia in the New Zealand countryside. I could see, like, they could think, ooh, maybe he could do Lord of the Rings.
Mm.
The clay creatures are inspired and the two strong characters, two strong female characters, and interesting look at obsession. Mm. Yeah, A.
Hey, awesome. What about you, David?
Yeah, I'm going to give it an A too, and I think it's a fascinating it's a turning point in Jackson's career, because this is where he steps out of the kind of the ultra low budget splatstick niche that he had created for himself, and though he would immediately detour back into genre, but on a much on ever increasing budgets, this foray into a still modestly budgeted, essentially art house film, which got itself an Oscar nomination, opened up all kinds of things for him, and sort of started to really show people outside the fans of his delightful gore movies what he could do.
Excellent. What about you, Stina?
Oh, I'd definitely give it an A. It's definitely, in my opinion, a horror movie because of that whole disturbing aspect of it. And I don't know. And because of that, it does fit in his... in his overall work.
His oeuvre is...
Yeah, oeuvre.
Some...
There you go. Oeuvre. There you go. But also, I much prefer Frighteners. But anyway.
Fair enough. All right. All right, well, then I will give it... I'll actually give it an A-. I think I still have some reservations with certain aspects of it. However, an A- for me is really good. Holy fuck, what was that? Did you hear that?
I did.
That's my upstairs neighbor screaming at his Xbox.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I
will be deleting this part out. But that was really distracting, and now I'm going to be complaining to management again.
Holy crap.
Because I should not be able to hear your words scream through my ceiling, even in an apartment. Yeah, now I'm really angry. So,
Chill.
Deep breaths.
Cleansing breaths.
Yeah, don't visit him with this nylon brick in it.
Not gonna do that. No, I don't condone murder. Mostly. Anyway, I enjoyed the film. I did think it was really quite good. It had some reservations. I agree with Paul that the visuals, though I guess they're kind of dated, but I didn't really get that sense, that feel. I thought they were really good. They held up pretty well. With, I mean, maybe some exceptions to some parts of it, but overall, I thought they held up. Yeah, and I did like that it's very focused treatment of obsession, and as I've already noted, I just, those opening, like, maybe 10, 15 minutes, I think, are just genius in terms of the setup. But, yeah, so that's what I would give it. So, alrighty, well, we're done. We did it.
Yay!
Thanks, Sean.
Cool. Alrighty, guys. Well, if you are listening to this and you have watched the film, you want to leave your comments, you can obviously do that at skiffyandfanty.com. And other than that, thank you, Paul, for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stina.
Thank you.
And I'll thank myself. You're welcome, Sean. that's so ridiculous. and on that note, awkward ending and scene.
Goodbye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
skiffyandfanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@skiffyandfanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
skiffyandfanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.